You are listening to the Signature Books podcast. Signature Books is a proud member of the Dialogue Podcast Network. You can support this podcast and others in our network by subscribing at dialoguejournal.com.
Welcome to the Signature Books podcast. I'm Barbara Jones Brown, Director of Signature Books Publishing. In honor of Women's History Month, today we're featuring just some of the many women authors and editors of various perspectives and backgrounds who are soon to publish their books with Signature. Let me tell you, we've got a really exciting lineup of women writers and subjects. From new historical insights on early Mormon polygamy to the effects of the Equal Rights Amendment in the 20th century, to cutting-edge topics of today, such as transgender women's rights, Signature has a plethora of books on women's studies in the pipeline. So please join me as I talk with these authors about their astounding works in progress. Our next guest is Cheryl Bruno. Cheryl has edited, put together a fabulous collection titled Secret Covenants, New Insights on Early Mormon Polygamy. Cheryl is a historian of early Mormon history. She's published in the Journal of Mormon History, the John Whitmer Historical Association's Journal as well, and recently published a book titled Method Infinite that's been very popular. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me here.
Well, I'm so excited to have you here. And one thing that excites me about this collection is to have a woman editing this book of essays, and you authored an essay yourself, of course, about polygamy. So often this subject is covered by men. And not to say that they don't do a great job, but I've always wondered, why is it that men are always telling the story about polygamy when most of the people who practice polygamy were women? So can you tell us a little bit about why you wanted to do this book and the background behind this collection?
Well, yeah, I will. But that's a very interesting question that you have there. And I think because when I was putting the book together and asking people to come together to present these academic essays, I found it was difficult for me to find women to participate in this. And the reason I think it was is because I was looking for more of an academic slant. And much of the work that's been done on women on polygamy, Mormon polygamy by women, has been more activist, which is great, you know, fabulous. But there is sort of a dearth of women writing in the academic field. And so I was glad to have several women be able to join with the men who have, like Todd Compton and Devery Anderson and others who've been so prolific on Mormon polygamy, Don Bradley. And then we have these women's voices now who are joining together in this group. So I'm really excited about the book.
We are so excited about it as well. And like you said, some really fabulous scholars on this that women are now joining. So can you tell us a little bit about the other essayists are Susan Staker and Marianne Clements, fantastic scholars. And of course, you wrote an essay as well. Can you tell us a little bit about those three essays written by women?
Oh, sure. So Susan Staker has been doing a collection of articles on Joseph Smith throughout the last few years. And so I've seen her articles in several different places. And in this one, she brings together, she calls it The Road to Secret Nauvoo, Abraham and Sarah and Joseph and Emma. So she compares the two couples and she talks about the Egyptian papers, Joseph Smith's Egyptian papers, and how they relate. And she talks about an amazing woman that Joseph Smith introduces to us named Katuman, this Egyptian figure. And so I think everyone will really enjoy that essay. It's deep. It's very deep. And if you're interested in the Abraham Egyptian papers, then you'll find this really fun. The essay I really want to highlight, though, is Marianne Clements. I believe this is her first published article. Mary Ann is the, she has been the president of the Theodore Turley Family History Association with Family Association. And she is a licensed genealogist. And so she does a lot of work in genealogy and family history. So what she does in this, let me just read you a little clip from her article. She says, without writings from women articulating their reasons for entering plural marriage, historians must examine and contextualize a woman's life experiences to uncover likely motives. So she's trying to find the motives of Theodore Turley married three sisters whose last name was Clift. So the Clift sisters, and she wants to find out their motivations for entering into polygamy. And we don't have any of their direct writings, so she does an amazing job of detective work, which is what genealogists are so good at. And she enters their world and their life experiences to try to figure out what their motivations were. And I think this is really apropos to Women's History Month.
Fascinating. My co-author is a descendant of Theodore Turley and one of those sisters, Richard E. Turley Jr. And I'm sure he's going to be interested. And I can't wait to read that article as well. Tell us about your article.
So my article is focused on Emma Smith. It's also a woman. And we talk in my article, I talk about Emma and also the Partridge sisters. So we talk about their marriages to Joseph Smith and really get into the historical ins and outs of that as well. So why did Emma always deny polygamy until the very end of her life? People have wondered that. And so I try to address that question.
Can you tell us in a nutshell?
I don't know. Alert. Well, I can tell you that I did not come to one firm conclusion, but I give several possibilities of why that could have been. And I try that to back that up with evidence.
Fantastic. And I think that's a question that many people have had over the years. So looking forward to seeing what you came up with. So why did you decide to do this book? Why now? I mean, there have been so many books on polygamy, Nauvoo polygamy. Why this book?
So how this happened was Gary Bergera, who was your predecessor, reached out to me and asked me to bring together a collection of articles. And I think what was in his head is he wanted me to bring together things that had already been written on polygamy and just put them together into a book. But I thought that there were enough great authors out there that we could come up with some brand new essays. And so I reached out to 10 different authors to ask them to do an original essay on the subject of polygamy. And some of them I gave a little bit of guidance of what kind of I wanted. And then others had some great ideas already in their minds that they'd been working on. And so we've got some great new things. Now, the only thing is that this was maybe 2 years ago. And so, you know, the publication process is, you know, a process. So it's been a while since we first got together and wrote our articles. And today, this subject has really blown up. And there's a big controversy over whether Joseph Smith practiced polygamy or not. Many of the essays do address that, but many of them just take for granted that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy. So I think that if we were going to write it today, it might be a little bit different, but I think it still is timely enough to really address that big explosion in at least a little bit of a way.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like historians of early Mormon history have felt like, wait, this, we already put this issue to bed. but here it is. It's arising anew. And so, yes, I agree. This is a very timely book, and it's perfect that it's coming out right when it is. Last question. How do you feel that women writing about polygamy is different from when men do? Do you as a woman author, a woman historian of the subject, feel like you bring any different insights to it because of your lived experience as a woman?
Oh, absolutely. I really do. And like Laurel Thatcher Ulrich talked a little bit about this when she wrote A Midwife's Tale and how women's history is so different than men's history. And we have our lived experiences that just enter into our writing. And we see this, like recently, Brian Hales has been talking about Mormon polygamy from a very authoritarian stance and talking about, you know, what the church policy is and that kind of thing. Almost butts heads with a woman's perspective where she is thinking about, when she's writing, she's thinking about how does this affect my life? How does this affect my marriage? And so I think there's quite a difference. Men do that to a certain extent, but I think they're more likely to separate that and just think about the documentation, you know, where women will, it's very personal.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I found that myself when I've read about early Mormon polygamy, written about post-manifesto polygamy, and heard others speak about it. So I agree. I see that myself. Cheryl, anything else that you want to share with us about your forthcoming book?
Well, I mean, polygamy is a hard subject, and especially to talk about during Women's History Month when we're celebrating the achievements of women, and sometimes polygamy is a little bit polarizing, where we're talking about issues of, you know, women, whether they're consenting to this, and hard issues. So maybe it's not exactly celebratory, but I think it does have a place in Women's History Month.
Absolutely. It's a very important part of history that needs to be examined and studied. And again, I love that women are doing it. So thank you so much. And of course, we will have another podcast coming up with more of your co-authors. And we'll be releasing that right before Secret Covenants comes out early this summer. So I hope Great. All our listeners will look forward to that.
Good to talk with you.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Our next guests are Ann Pimentel and MacArthur Krishna. Ann lives in Utah with her husband and four boys, and she helps run an organization called Meeting House Mosaic, which is a nonprofit trying to diversify Christian art. MacArthur is an author who writes about girls and women's issues because she wants to empower women's voices. And she is the author of Girls Who Choose God, A Girl's Guide to Heavenly Mother and Cherish. Anna MacArthur, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
We are so excited to be publishing you and your work at Signature Books. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your project that we've got in the works now and how the idea for this project came to be.
Like many good ideas in this world, it started with a question. So I was at an activity day teaching about the Gospel Topics essay on Mother in Heaven. And a little girl in the front row, Ashley, raised her hand and asked a great question. And I was like, Ashley, that's a great question. Let's talk about that. And then at the end, she said to me, you know, it'd be a good book title, a good book idea to do a book about women who had questions. And I sat there for a second and I said, yes, it would. That would be an amazing. I'll get back to you on that. So I had it kind of in the back of my mind. And then I was sitting in a meeting and we were discussing some changes that were coming in our church, the LDS church. And a man in the meeting said to me, MacArthur, the brethren don't need your or anyone else's ideas. And for a second, I went blink, blink, because I was caught off guard. And then honestly, I just cracked up, which is funny when you're in a Zoom meeting and like you're you know, snickering. Because while the brethren and the prophet have ultimate stewardship over what changes should be enacted, and 100% God can speak directly to their brains to make things change, we have a long history, as long as this church has existed, of ideas coming to the brethren and coming to the church from various sources, that God can inspire lots of people. And some of those inspirations have dramatically changed the face of the church. So for instance, we just celebrated the Relief Society. You know, March 17th is the founding date of the Relief Society. That was not an idea that came to the brethren. That was an idea that came to women to say, we would like to do this. And then God took their idea and made it, you know, infinitely grander and more vibrant than maybe what they'd originally imagined. But what's crucial about this is I was sitting there in this meeting and thinking about this as I thought, how many ideas are out there that we don't even consider because we don't think ideas are needed? And maybe we could learn from the history of women who have changed the face of our church and contributed in creative and interesting ways. If we taught this history, then maybe we would have the idea that women's ideas and women's contribution is needed and is valuable. And so I know Anne, right? And I know that Anne is passionate and a good writer and fun to be around. And so I said, hey, Anne, don't you want to work on this with me? Like, don't you think this sounds like a fun idea? Lo and behold, she had lots of resources and books and ideas about women who had done this very thing, right? And so in our book, there'll be some names that you well recognize, but there'll also be stories that will blow your mind, which is super delightful.
Stories from around the world, right? Not just in Utah, not just in the United States, but international stories. And then stories even going back to biblical times. Anne, do you want to talk Absolutely. A little bit about that?
Yeah, we wanted to have a really broad range. A lot of our knowledge of how the church was founded and things is based in white women that, you know, lived in Nauvoo. And that's important history. And we want to celebrate that as well. But there is such a rich history of women around the world that are making an impact. There's things that didn't impact women in Utah in their early history because it was, you know, a fairly tight knit, you know, geographically small group of women, when they came to Utah, for example. But we're going to include a story of a woman in Jamaica that she and her husband would travel around to pick up different members every day that there was a church activity. And so they decided, we really need to have our church meetings on one day. That would be so much easier than going every day over miles and miles to pick up these members. And so that's how we got church put onto one day of a week. And, you know, that has changed how we worship, how we are as members. And that's so important. And so there's just really incredible stories of women around the world that have left a lasting impact on the church. And we just aren't aware of all of them. So we want to bring that to light.
I would love a future generation to hear these stories and think, what can I contribute? What talents do I have? What ideas do I have? What is it that I have to offer if I want to build Zion, right? I mean, the hope of this kind of book is not just that we think, oh, women in history are great, but we also really take into ourselves the opportunity to contribute in whatever ways and whatever talents we have.
Fantastic. And we at Signature hope it has that kind of impact as well, of course. Why do you think this book is needed right now? Why now?
I mean, it is such an interesting time to live in this world as members of this church. And as women specifically, it can be hard sometimes, you know, and there is so much, like MacArthur was saying, there's so much that women can offer and can bring to the table. And we have such great ideas, such unique perspectives. And so I think a book like this is really important right now because women and young women specifically need to know that they can contribute to the church. They can make a difference. They can share their talents, their knowledge, whatever it is. We're missing out on that right now. And so I think it's important that girls and women understand that we can contribute and hopefully that can help keep women in the church. You know, if that's where they need to be, if that's how they feel they need to contribute is through the church, they need to have a voice and have a path forward for that. And we want to show that path.
I think it's also timely because President Nelson a few years ago put out a call, right? Plea to my sisters. And he has this great invitation and even admonition to tell women to step in, to speak their voices, to participate in community, in the church. Like it was more than an invitation to me. It felt like Elder President Nelson really understanding that this was lacking and that this needed to be, as Susan Madsen says, the sisters needed to be unleashed, right? That's her word, unleashed. And I think what's interesting is that women heeded that call. And women stepped forward and voiced and participated. And what happens when a lot of voices hit a system that's not used to having that way of functioning, that the system gets pushed. It's uncomfortable, right? So as women heed this and women step into this, for example, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the city council that was just elected was an all-female many multi-race board, right? And people in the city started commenting and reacting and being worried that there were no white men on the board. And so the woman takes the mic, one of the newly elected members, and she says, for hundreds of years, this board has had all white men on it, and there was no discussion or concern about the importance of representation. And now, apparently, there is. We're concerned about representation. So here's the thing. It's the same sort of thing that we see going on in the structure of our faith right now, is that when women feel compelled, feel called to step up and participate and contribute, and they hit a system that's not used to that, it's uncomfortable, right? And we're seeing that even just in the last couple of days. And so from my standpoint, this is like a growing pains part of our faith, which is good. We believe in ongoing revelation. We believe in eternal progression. We believe in things continuing to evolve. The way we are is not the way we'll end up to be. And so acknowledging that as women are answering the prophet's call, that things are going to be uncomfortable as we all figure out how to adjust to these voices and rearrange structures to pull voices in, there's going to be this period of time that feels a little, you know, uneasy. And I think that uneasiness points to growth. Growth happens when things are in motion, not when things are static. And if we believe that we as individuals should grow and we as an institution should grow, then being uncomfortable and pushing in is vital. It's vital for growth. And so what Signature Books is doing in your growth, right, and the ways that you've decided to step forward and push out in new spaces for Signature, I think is a microcosm of what we are experiencing as a people. And I think it's good.
Thank you, Krishna. I resonate so much with what you're saying, and I agree. And just being able to head Signature and be able to provide a platform for all kinds of women and giving them their voices from wherever they stand and however they see things, empowering women, all of you, has been a thrill for me. It's been a great opportunity I'm really grateful for. And again, so excited and so grateful to have you two as future Signature authors. Can you take just a real quick minute and explain the format of the book? This will be something a little bit different than we traditionally do at Signature, but what it'll look like and the target age group.
So our target age is, you know, maybe 9, 11 to 14 of girls, but MacArthur's learned through publishing some of her other books that women also are really drawn to these books and use them in Relief Society or at Young Women's Camp or, you know, wherever it is. And so we're going for a really energetic, exciting, fun book. There's going to be a lot of color and some great art. We've got a really great artist that's going to come on and help out with this book. And so we just really want to encourage women to be excited about the possibilities. And so you're going to feel that in the book. You're going to feel that energy in the book. And we're going to have, you know, description of the women and the stories and, you know, what their experiences are. There will be questions that will help you think about what you can do, what you can share, how you can use your talents. Going to be lots of great little tidbits of interesting facts and different things that help kind of fill out the story. So it's going to be really energetic and fun. We're really excited.
That's great. Well, thank you both. And we hope our listeners, our readers will look forward to your forthcoming book. It's just barely starting in the process right now, so we don't have a title yet, but sometime next year, look forward to this book coming out. Thank you again for your participation today.
Thank you.
Signature with this book idea. It's so exciting.
Thanks, Barbara.
Yay, yay.
Thanks. My next guest is Robin Rich, who is a longtime leader in the tech industry, and she is a history maker herself. She was the first president and publisher of the church-owned Deseret News in its entire 170-year history. She's the first woman to hold that title. Robin, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Barb.
So tell us a little bit about the book that you've put together. It's an anthology of various women's voices and experiences.
Yeah, it was really fun for me to put it together. I went and interviewed a bunch of women that were LDS and that were making their career decisions between 1968 and 1974. And their experiences with choosing to have a career and also choosing to stay part of their faith community during those tumultuous times. I learned a lot about those times. I didn't really understand that time period, and to understand that they were not only dealing with the fact that there was a priesthood ban on people of African descent, as well as kind of a major push by the LDS church for women to stay within the home and have that be the choice, the only choice kind of available to them, and how they kind of navigated both of those issues during that time period.
Yeah. And so why those years? Why 1968 to 74? What's going on in American history?
So what was super interesting, and I, what really was the impetus of why I did the book, is I was out to lunch with Christine Durham. She was the first woman to be on the Supreme Court here in Utah, and first Chief Justice. And she was telling me about some of her experiences in the 1970s, you know, and I, of course, was a little bit too young to really understand that. And also, I'm not from here. And so understanding kind of some of the things she went through during that time period, what you saw was it was the end of the civil rights had been happening in the 60s, which led right into the women. A lot of the women I talked to, they had marched on their college campuses for civil rights. Then they'd go to church and it was a different experience. And that was really hard for them to just, you know, to just understand, like, how I'm marching for this, and yet my own church doesn't necessarily maybe embrace the same things I'm marching for by appearances. So that was going on at the same. And what happened really out of that civil rights movement is the women's movement in the United States happened really as we went into the 70s, because the women had been marching. And then they're like, hey, we actually don't have checking accounts. We're not allowed to have checking accounts. We're not allowed to have a mortgage. We're not allowed to be, we can be fired for becoming pregnant. It's totally legal to advertise the same job that, you know, pays $10 to a man and only three to a woman. So there was all these things that they're like, wait a minute. And this became second wave feminism. And they were really pushing forward for kind of equality is what they were looking for. And ERA was happening as well, which was the Equal Rights Amendment, which would have constitutionalized equality regardless of your gender. So all these things were happening during them. And I wanted to capture that time before the priesthood ban was lifted, that there were these major social issues happening in the United States and where the faith community might have had different positions on it than an individual member did, and how they navigated that. And so I wanted to capture, and that was a really fraught time, frankly, with so many things going on in socially. And this is the first time at that time, like in colleges, women couldn't get financial aid. Scholarships weren't necessarily available. There were certain colleges and degrees they could go after, not others. And so there was a lot of change happening in the broader U.S. And so I stuck to the U.S. because I think even different places in the U.S., it was a different experience. But to just try and frame up, what does it look like, you know, in that time period where there were social issues conflicting with your faith community and how they resolve those?
Fantastic. And so you interviewed all kinds of women in putting together this anthology. So famous people like Chief Justice Christine Durham, some other very well-known women, and then some just regular everyday women like the rest of us, and also white women, women of color. This era meant different things to different women depending on what their background was. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that one part was a little not surprising to me, but it was so enriching to me, frankly, is to hear different women's experiences around the same issue. So, for example, many of the people of color felt like the women's movement was a white woman's problem. They were more worried about working two jobs or providing for their family. It wasn't necessarily a question of like, are you going to work? That didn't seem like a question that they would even ask themselves, because that's not the situation they were in. Other women, and this is what was so enriching to me, is there are so many amazing women. There are amazing women probably living next door to you that you don't know her story. And just the grit and the ability to parse out things and say, wow, that doesn't necessarily fit for me. What fits for me? And be able to have the courage to know what fits for you and communicate with God and get that answer from God and feel good about it. And then be able to articulate it to those around you. All the women I interviewed, it was interesting. None of them felt like it was their job to change any structure, but they felt like it was their job to live true to what was the best for them and their families. And then be very articulate in their spheres of influence to help other people understand that we're all unique. And why would it look the same for all of us? You know, why wouldn't their answer be go to medical school and do your fellowship at Harvard? Like, why wouldn't it look like that for somebody? And for somebody else, it might look like, you know, you're going to stay home, whatever. Like, it should look different. And I think they were very articulate in articulating that as much as they could in their sphere of influence to try and raise people's awareness that we're not one size fits all. And especially the people I talked to of color, that was very clear. Like, we're not one size fit all. When it comes to, you know, things that come out in our culture, in the LDS culture, or even from the pulpit. Like, I think the job is, what I got from it was the job is to go figure out what that's like for you.
Great. Well, I'm so excited about this book. It's in the pipeline. We haven't picked a title for it yet, but it'll be coming out from Signature Books soon. And again, it's an anthology of all kinds of women's voices who made career choices, who made choices about working or didn't have that choice, whether or not they worked in the late 60s and early 70s during a very transitional time in American history, in Mormon history, in Utah history for women. So we'll look forward to that book from you, Robin Rich, as a change-making woman yourself. It'll be great to have that coming forth from you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next guests are Katie Ludlow Rich and Heather Sundahl. Heather is a marriage and family therapist who's participated in the Exponent 2 for 28 years, and she currently serves on Exponent 2's board as the historian. Katie Ludlow Rich is a writer and independent scholar of Mormon women's history. She joined the Exponent 2 blog in 2021. So maybe we start with, for our listeners who don't know what Exponent 2 is, give a little background on what that is and the book you're writing about Exponent 2.
Great. Yeah, we are writing 50 years of Exponent 2. Exponent 2 is the longest running independent publication for Mormon women and gender minorities. In 1974, a group of Boston area Mormon housewives, graduate students, and young professionals started it as a quarterly newspaper founded on the dual platforms of Mormonism and feminism. It quickly grew to become a national platform connecting the burgeoning network of Mormon feminists across the United States and beyond. And this year marks its 50th anniversary. And we edited this book and wrote the organization's history to mark this significant milestone.
It's not just a history. We also have curated some of the best of, and oh my gosh, was that a process? It felt a little like Sophie's Choice going through these beautiful essays and poetry and trying to sort of pick pieces that represented certain points in time, certain perspectives. And it's just going to be a beautiful book.
I'm so excited for it. Maybe tell us a little bit more about the format. So you've written some essays, you've written some introductions, and then you have these other, poetry and other classic essays and so forth. Can you tell us how you've laid out the book?
Yeah, so we have an original history of the organization at the front, and we did a lot of interviews and research through the archives and went through the whole publications to read all of that, to write that history. And then we have selected works divided into units, and we have introductory essays for each unit. And then, like Heather was saying, we have a variety of essays and poetry and just a lot of the most significant work from the 50 years of the publication.
And it's more than just a publication, right? It's an organization. Maybe could you talk a little bit about what the original Exponent was? And what the Exponent 2 is, who founded it, why it was founded.
Yeah, go for it, Katie.
Yeah, so the original Woman's Exponent was a Utah-based periodical that Emmeline Wells was the editor for most of its long run. And it was a very suffragist paper and dealt with a lot of the things that were going on with women in Utah. And
Emmeline Wells was the General Relief Society president, correct?
She did become so, yeah, at the end of her life. Yeah, she was the General Relief Society president. And in 1972, this group of Boston women were invited to teach an institute class on Mormon women's history. And as they were preparing their lectures, Susan Kohler found at Harvard's Widener Library, she found these bound volumes of the original woman's exponent. And she had never heard of this paper. And she digs through it and she's like, oh, this is the time period that my grandparents were living in Salt Lake. And she's just amazed by this paper and how these women were feminists. And she brings it to her friends.
Yeah, they were feminists. They were advocating for women's rights. And so these women in Boston, Cambridge, they were in the process of sort of doing that very same thing. And so it felt serendipitous, fate, whatever you want to call it, that these feminist women who are advocating for women, advocating for women's rights. This is the time when ERA is starting to, you know, be discussed. And then they find this, their heritage, they find this sort of like feminist, intellectual, spiritual heritage of women modeling for them how to go about doing this. And it's like, why shouldn't we have a paper? Mm-hmm. You know, why not?
And I think among those best known folks who started Exponent 2 were Claudia Bushman, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Claudia was the founding editor. There was Laurel and Judy Dushku and Susan Kohler and a bunch of women that we get to talk about and introduce and give you more of their stories in that history.
Fantastic. Well, it's a perfect time to have this book come out on the 50th anniversary of Exponent 2. What insights have you two gained through working on Exponent 2? The history of Exponent 2, I should say.
So three things that Katie and I have sort of realized is that, you know, it was formed on the dual platform of Mormonism and feminism. And when they started out, when these women got together and they did the pink issue for Dialogue, that some of the men were critical of them, saying,
wait a minute, back up. What's Dialogue for our listeners who don't know? So, the pink issue. Fill us in.
So it's a journal of Journal of Mormon Thought.
Yeah.
So, and when did Dialogue get started?
1965.
Okay. So it had been around, not quite a decade, but it had been around. And these women were asked to, why don't you take over an issue and have it all be about, you know, women's issues and these things. And the women got a lot of blowback. These men were saying to them, not all the men, but some of the men were saying, you're not doing feminism right. This isn't what feminism is. And they're kind of like, excuse me, who's got the female body? Who's got the lived experience? And so from the very beginning, Exponent has really sort of challenged, like, what does it mean to be a feminist? You know, back in the 70s, there were people who sort of said, well, this is what it means. This is the feminist yardstick. And these women are like, well, we're over here, but we're still claiming this label. And so they really sort of have expanded what it means to be feminist. And then I feel like they've done the same thing when it comes to what does it mean to be Mormon? You know, what is a Mormon? What does a faithful Mormon look like? And they have always kind of pushed the boundaries and sort of stretched some of these things. And then over the years, in our work, we saw it too, Katie, that they also expanded what the definition of a woman was, both now in terms of, you know, gender minorities, but also in terms of sexuality. There were women who were lesbians who were contributing to the Exponent. And, you know, that was controversial. It's like, you're not a real woman. If you're not married and have children, you know, that's what a woman is. And so Exponent has always been about expanding these ideas, creating more room for more people. And when you get more room, you get more conflict, right, Katie?
Absolutely. And that's something that they really found a way to disagree together. And work through disagreement through this like group project of the paper and through talking through these important issues. Like in the 1970s, it was a really big deal, the debate on whether mothers should work outside the home. And one of my favorite examples of how they managed this kind of conflict was in their third issue, on a single page, they had two articles that were seemingly opposite about this issue. So they had Truly Brave Women, an article by Catherine Ann Anderson that argues that mothers of young children must work to prioritize the care of those children and stay home with them during that season of their life. And then in A Working Mother, Judy Dushku writes about a mother who's a doctor who relies on hired childcare and partnership with her husband to balance career and family. And so on this single page, they have these different perspectives, and not to diminish either perspective, but to expand what was acceptable, like what to hear more stories about women's lived experience and be able to listen to each other. And
Exponent was doing both and long before it was cool.
Well, it sounds fascinating. It sounds like it's still very timely for today. So why is this book important now? Other than, of course, it's the 50th anniversary of Exponent 2, but what impact do you hope it will have? Why does it matter today?
Yeah, in the women's movement in the 1970s, women were really driven by their history, by discovering women's history, and they were trying to think back through their mothers to get this alternative perspective from the male-only narratives that they were given. And I think that is something that a lot of Mormon women feel like we still experience, is just being handed the story of significant men in our heritage. And I hope that this volume kind of gives more people to have space to find themselves in the story of feminism and of Mormonism, and find ways to connect to each other through thinking back through these significant leaders in our history.
Fantastic. Anything you would add to that, to Heather?
I just love that we're getting so much of this stuff documented. It's really easy for people who are younger to kind of get online and just find some things. And then all of a sudden they start having these ahas and connecting these dots. And sometimes we can feel like, oh my gosh, like I've discovered feminism. Like these are these new ideas. And I love that Exponent has been wrestling with these things for so long. I feel like it's really, and maybe this is because I'm getting older, I feel like it's really important to not just acknowledge the shoulders on which you stand, but to see that they're there. Because sometimes I think we don't even realize all the work and all the thought and the things that have gone before. And I think that our current ideas are so much more nuanced and informed if we have a little bit of an understanding of the people who paved the way.
Fantastic. Okay, Heather and Katie, their book is 50 Years of Exponent 2. That's not necessarily the final title. We haven't decided on that yet, but it will be coming out later this summer in time for the 50th anniversary of the Exponent 2 retreat. So we're excited for your work, and I think readers are really going to enjoy reading it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our next guest is Alice Faulkner Birch. Alice wears many hats. She is on the editorial advisory committee for Signature Books Publishing. She is a researcher with the Sema Hadithi African American Heritage and Cultural Foundation. And she is the author of, well, the editor of a collection of essays titled My Lord, He Calls Me, recently published by Deseret Book. Finally, she is an essayist in our forthcoming book from Signature Books titled Writing Mormon History 2, in which she tells her story behind the writing and the producing of My Lord, He Calls Me. Welcome to the podcast, Alice.
Thank you.
So the other thing that we've got in the pipeline with Signature that you're working on is a book about the Genesis Group. Do you want to briefly just tell our listeners what the Genesis Group is?
Yes. The Genesis Group was founded in 1971, and the founding of it was led by three Black American men, Ruffin Bridgeforth, Darius Gray, and Eugene Orr. And they were wanting a safe place where Black Americans in Utah could meet and where they could conduct meetings, because as the church's priesthood restriction ban was still in effect, not just men, but women were not allowed to do prayers in their wards. They were not allowed to, the men were not allowed to participate in any priesthood function, passing sacrament, attending priesthood meetings, holding callings, things like that. And men and women were not allowed to attend the temple, to be sealed child to parent, husband to wife, to do proxy sealings for others. They were not allowed to have a temple recommend at all. And so these three men decided to meet with the first presidency of the church. And at the first meeting, they discussed what they presented to them, what they wanted, and then events went from there. They actually had several meetings with the persons appointed to visit with them, and they were three junior apostles at the time. It was Boyd K. Packer, Gordon B. Hinckley, and Thomas S. Monson. And those three junior apostles were appointed to meet with these three Black American men, and they had several meetings. And then at one point it was decided that the Genesis group would be established, and they left it up to Gene Ruffin and Darius to name the group. And they chose the name Genesis, believing that it would be the beginning of a big change within the church for Black Americans in being accepted and in being held equally as white Americans. And so the Genesis group was established, and they met once a month, and they still do meet once a month. And it's like a fireside. It used to be a bit more extensive than what it is now. There was a Relief Society president, and the women would get together and have a meeting. And there was a young men's president and a young women's president. The young women would get together and meet. The young men would get together and meet. There would be activities for the youth. There'd be activities for the adults, activities for the whole family. And every month at the regular once a month meeting, there is a speaker and there is gospel music that is sang by a choir, as well as sang by the entire group of attendees at the meeting. And Genesis still exists today.
Well, and I am so excited that you will be writing a history of it, because obviously this is a very important history in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and one that needs to be told. And for you to write the book about this, yeah, is wonderful. You used to be a Relief Society president in the Genesis group. Is that right?
Yes. So I was the last Relief Society president before they stopped doing that function in Genesis. And so this book will be very different from other histories of the Genesis group that have been written. One thing that makes it very different is that it will be written from the point of view of a Black American person who attended Genesis and who was one of the leaders in the Genesis Leadership Council.
Well, it's perfect that you be the one to write that, Alice. So I hope our listeners...
You're kind, Barbara.
True. You're the perfect person to write it. And I hope our listeners will look forward to that coming in the future. Let's talk about now Writing Mormon History 2, which is edited by Joe Geisner and coming out later this summer from Signature Books. And you have an essay in it. Do you want to talk about your essay and the story that you share? I guess I should back up and say that this book, Writing Mormon History 2, as well as the first one titled Writing Mormon History, are collections of essays from authors who've written important books in Mormon history. And so we're so excited to have you in this second volume talking about your writing of My Lord, He Calls Me. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So my essay is about the background of me putting together this book, My Lord, He Calls Me. And I share some stories. There are some things that I share in my essay for this book that I haven't shared in interviews that I've given, because I wanted people who bought the book to be able to read my essay. And instead of saying, oh, I've seen her interviews, and this is just the same thing that she said in those interviews. And I didn't want that to be the case. I wanted them to say, oh, wow, this is different. So I also include with my essay some documents. Because I am a collector of Black history in Utah. As I go along, I look at things and I say, oh, this would be good to save because this is pertinent in this manner. And so there are documents that I save and pictures that I save, flyers that I save, things like that. And so I saved some documents that I share as part of my essay. Our book won two awards, first place for the Latter-day Saints in media, I'm sorry, Latter-day Saints in publishing, media, and the arts awarded us first place in the history biography category and second place in the oral, I'm sorry, I have that wrong, an oral, not oral, audiobook category. And I think it's the other way around. I'm sorry. And I share about that, about winning those awards. I share about some of the difficult experiences that I had in compiling the book and in editing the book. My essay follows the same, I think, the same feeling as the book itself, whereas the book takes a spiritual, not religious, but a spiritual perspective of Black Americans being members of the church, as well as a matter of fact perspective. My essay in the book is from a spiritual perspective of what I experienced and in compiling the book.
Fantastic. I'm so excited about this volume, not only for your essay, but there are several women who have contributed to sharing their stories behind their books. Yeah. Others include Jill Mulvey-Durr, talking about her decades-long career in writing Mormon women's history. P. Jane Hafen, Taos Pueblo, she writes about a book that she co-edited with Brendan Rensink on Native American histories, Mormon histories. We have that in there. And then I wrote an essay about the writing of Vengeance Is Mine, The Mountain Meadows Massacre and Its Aftermath. So grateful to have your essay in there. And again, these other women's authors' essays as well. So look forward to that one, folks, Writing Mormon History too. Alice, thank you for all that you do to contribute to Signature Books, not only as an author, but also again as a member of our editorial advisory committee. You are an invaluable part of Signature Books. And we're so lucky to have you participating with us.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks. Our next guest is Lori Lee Hall, who's writing a memoir about her remarkable experiences, her remarkable life. Lori, welcome to the podcast.
So glad to be here, Barbara. Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about your memoir? This is a preview. The memoir is coming out this fall, but tell us a little bit about it.
Sure, I'd be glad to. But first, I want to note March being Women's History Month, and I'm just really grateful that I can participate in the celebration of the contribution of women in the United States, and that Signature Book recognizes that a transgender woman has a place in the narrative of the history of women and their contributions in the country, both past, present and future. So kudos to Signature for recognizing to include someone like myself in a celebration of women.
Absolutely. And your voice is so important as we discuss all kinds of women's experiences and backgrounds and so forth. So we are thrilled. We are honored to have you as a Signature author, Lori.
Awesome. So, and that comes right to the reason for writing my memoir is to help to tell the story from my perspective, from my lived experience that contributes to the overall narrative of the experience of transgender women in both in the late 20th century, the 1960s, 1970s, and so forth, when I was a child, on up to today. We live at a particular time when significant backlash is occurring against transgender people. Jennifer Finley Penny Boylan, who is an outspoken writer and trans activist and lecturer, has noted that the anti-trans sentiment has taken the place of abortion rights as the current far conservative rights boogeyman and boogeywoman in animating their base. And we see 500 or more anti-LGBTQ laws being submitted and discussed in 2023. That number will probably be exceeded in 2024. And a significant, a disproportionate amount of those anti and crippling and erasing laws that are going into place all over Red America, so-called, are against transgender people, and particularly transgender youth. So it's important for me and timely to tell my story, to add to, you know, the prime narratives, if you will, of the transgender experience at this time when so many people need to be able to learn and understand and appreciate who we are. We know very well that once a person is known in a personal way, that many biases and prejudices break down and go away. Education on this topic is so important to me. And I have a story that, you know, that spans these last 60 years of experience as a trans person, both in trying to be seen as a child and then trying to hide as a teen, and then totally burying my identity as an adult and attempting to live and walk in the world as I was assigned as a male, to then discovering what it meant to be transgender and finding that that was what was broken in my life, and then having the opportunity to put my life back together and now live it more fully. And all of that taking place in my particular case in a crossroads with being an active Latter-day Saint. And not only that, but a leader in the Mormon Church ecclesiastically, as well as a prominent employee of the church, in many cases spending time in the senior boardrooms and higher corridors of church leadership, and to have that all come crashing down to pay the price to live authentically. It's a story that because of all those experiences, I have a voice, and I feel like I have a responsibility to use that voice and to tell the story and to create understanding. And hopefully, along with many, many others, I hope there'll be many, many others who tell their stories as well to combat the, you know, the horrible backlash that takes place, that's taking place right now.
Yeah. And I agree with you. I'm so grateful that you're willing to share your voice and share your story. I have long felt that if there's a fear of someone who is different from us, it just means we don't know that person. We don't understand that person. And then when we come to know people who are different from us, we discover that we love them. And we discover that they're not scary, that they're different from whatever our identity might be, but they're human beings, and there's so much that we do share. And I'm so grateful to you, Lori, besides just publishing with Signature for your friendship. You have taught me so much. I have learned so much about the trans experience, and I've been grateful to you for being vulnerable with me and being willing to share your experience with me. And that's why I'm so excited about your memoir, because I think anyone, whether they have a transgender friend or not, by reading your memoir, they will learn about trans people and realize this is not a scary thing. It's just a different aspect of the human condition. And we're all different. We all have different identities. And so I hope it leads to all of us appreciating our different identities, whatever they may be, and celebrating our differences rather than being afraid of them.
And for folks, particularly young people, to be able to live safely and be able to obtain health care and to be able to grow up in a place where they're equal before the law and have the same opportunities that their peers have.
Absolutely. And I think I feel so lucky also because you asked me to edit your memoir. And so as I've been going through it and reading it, it's so enlightening. And I think it'll really make a difference for so many people when they read your memoir.
I hope so. It's been an amazing process writing it.
Yeah.
I really kind of started putting fingertips to the keyboard 2 years ago now. And so it's been a journey of self-discovery first and being vulnerable, first of all, to myself. There were in my memory various points, dots, if you will, of information that as I started to write, the dots got in order and the dots started connecting. And as I'm sitting here connecting dots, sometimes I'm experiencing trauma all over again. Sometimes I'm just looking at the screen and bawling as I consider how A led to B, led to C, and how those things tie together in ways I'd never thought of before. Mm-hmm. And yet it feels like I know myself so much better now than I thought I did before, or that I could have been ever before I started writing. So it's been a marvelous personal experience. And I really think it has helped me to be strengthened in being willing and able to be vulnerable in talking to yourself and to talking to others and to telling this story. I've been, like you say, interviewing a lot for the last 7 years or so in settings such as this, but it's getting easier to share many of the complex and intimate details of this journey. And it forms a kind of bravery that I didn't have before and a desire to share. So the writing of it has been a marvelous experience for a first time writer like myself.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for your willingness to be vulnerable and to engage with some traumatic parts of your life in order to share your story with us. That takes a lot of courage. And I've been so impressed because, as you said, you're a first-time writer, you're an architect, but your ability to share your story has been remarkable, and it's been very moving for me to read, and I cannot wait for our readers to read it as well. So maybe just really quickly talk about your life before you started writing this memoir. Of course, you're an architect. You were a chief architect of temples for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Mm-hmm. For several years.
And a state president at the time that you started your transition to live authentically. Do you want to briefly just talk about that background?
For Latter-day Saints reading my story, there'll be all kinds of juicy tidbits and Easter eggs about what it's like to be a church leader and having gender identity in the back of my mind, what it's like to be sitting with senior brethren of the senior leadership of the church and addressing the design and construction of temples with them on a regular basis, every week, every month, for several years, to be involved in all of that work. And you know, the tragedy of the story, which we open chapter one with, is when that all came crashing down because I was living now as my true self, as Lori Lee, and could not continue to serve in the church, could not continue to be employed by the church, could not continue to, you know, offer my talents and abilities and experience to the work that I had spent my entire life, really my adult life, building up. So yeah, I did all of those things. Now I get to do different things. I continue with a private practice. I live in Kentucky now, still have projects in Utah and have projects back here as well. And get to watch grandchildren grow up and just having a very peaceful, happy life. The end of this month that of women's history that recognizes the contribution of women, maybe appropriately, the last day of the month of March is Transgender Visibility Day. And visibility is an interesting thing because it would be a great peaceful thing to be invisible as a transgender person. And yet it's so important, on the other hand, to be visible. So it's an interesting dichotomy that I'd like to blend in and disappear, and yet I need to be more and more visible and vulnerable. So we remember the importance of making sure that people know who we are and can see us, maybe in our normality, can see us as normal society members, citizens of the nation. But that's all coming up here at the end of the month as well.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for bringing that up. And thank you for being visible. Thank you for being out there. Thank you for doing what you're doing and sharing your remarkable story, Lori. And I do believe it will make a big difference for generations to come. You are a true history maker. And again, we're so excited about your forthcoming memoir this fall from Signature Books. It will be groundbreaking. Thank you so much for your time today, and we'll be hearing more from you soon.
Yes. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you. With us now is Dr. Carrie Spencer-Prey. She's an assistant professor of writing at Stevens University in Maryland and editor of our forthcoming book from Signature titled The Book of Queer Mormon Joy, which is an anthology of all kinds of folks across the LGBT plus spectrum. And we're so excited about this one. Carrie, do you want to tell us a little bit about the book? Give us an overview and why you decided to do this book.
Well, we decided to do the book because I had edited a previous volume of stories. And when I very first was trying to decide whether or not to come out, whether or not to leave my mixed orientation marriage, I was looking around for people that I could talk to, anybody that I could talk to, somebody. And I literally only knew one gay woman in the entire world at that point that I could message. And she wasn't Mormon. And she was literally like the only one I knew that I could message. And so I sent her a message and said, like, do you know anybody in the church or that I could talk to you about some things? And she gave me a couple of names and also sort of told me about Affirmation, which was the organization for queer Mormons that existed. So I went to, there happened to be an Affirmation conference that, like, it was literally like a week later or something. It was very close to when I'd had the talk with her. And there at the conference that I went to, I met Jen Lee Smith. And Jen Lee had said, I have been trying to find stories. I've been trying to find people's stories because I've found a couple of stories about queer Mormons, but it's only ever gay men. There's nobody else. Where's the lesbians? There's no stories about the women. There's no stories about what it means to be a queer Mormon woman. And so she and I sort of teamed up on this. It was her project, Jen's project, and her vision. She wanted to create an anthology of voices from the entire LGBTQ spectrum of Mormonism. And so the result of that was our first book, which was called I Spoke to You with Silence. And when it was released, we tried really hard in that book to tell the whole truth about what it means to be a queer Mormon. But what we realized after we'd released it was that the story felt very incomplete because it's a traumatic story. It's a sad story. There's not a lot of joy or happiness involved in being a queer Mormon. We we thought really hard about, did we want to dedicate the book to one of our friends who had died? Because in our hearts, we knew that if we were going to start doing that, we would never run out of books to dedicate. There was too many queer Mormons that were dead, too many queer Mormons that had had really tragic and awful stories. And it felt very heavy. It was overwhelming and heavy that to realize that this was the truth. And the story wasn't finished yet. The story hadn't come to a resolution yet. And so we thought when you called me and talked to me about possibly putting together a book, I said that I would be interested in telling a joyful story, because sometimes you have to create the things that you need before they exist. You have to imagine it to make it real. And so we started collecting stories from queer people that were joyful. And it took a little bit of time to collect that many. Like, there was a lot of people I talked to that were just like, I just can't imagine anything joyful about being a queer Mormon. Everything is awful. And we were like, we know, but we're trying to create something here that's a little bit different. And we did finally, after, I think, how long did it take us? Was it like 2 years that it took us to gather the stories? At least a year. I'd have to go back.
A little over a year. You may not know this, but when I received the job to become director of Signature Books, you were the first person I reached out to, even before I had, just before I started Signature. And I had found you, I discovered you on Twitter, and I loved your sense of humor. And I loved the perspectives that you shared. And I thought, oh, I'd love it if Carrie did a book. And I reached out to you about this. And you said, as long as we can do it on joy. And I said, let's do it. So it's been a little over, it took a little over a year.
Okay. Yeah.
All the stories. Yeah.
So it took a little over a year. And I was very happy. Like, it was, I was anxious at first, just because I had known what it was like the first time around with the book and how heavy it can sit. And the hard part of putting the stories together was the realization sort of after the fact that joy is a very complicated emotion. It's not as simple as happiness. It's not as simple as a happy ending. It's sort of defined by its opposite. It's defined by hardship and despair that you overcome. It's defined by becoming free when you've only ever been trapped. And so there was still a little bit of heaviness there, but I'm very happy with where we ended up coming out with the story. So they ended up, I think, really accomplishing what we had set out to accomplish, which was to create something that didn't exist, to try to invent it into existence, to say, like, no, this is what it looks like to be queer and Mormon and joyful.
Yeah. I love what the book's foreword writer, Carolyn Pearson, wrote after she read this manuscript, that this collection that you put together. And she said, when I first wrote Goodbye, I Love You, which was about the death of her husband from a mixed orientation marriage, when he died of AIDS in the 1980s, and she published that book, I believe it was in 1986. And she said, when I wrote that book, I never dreamed that someday I'd be writing a book, a foreword to a book about Mormons who have found their joy, queer Mormons, post-Mormons who have found their joy rather than just struggling to survive and live, but finding joy. And I think that's what's so great about this book. I'm so glad you had the idea to make it joyful and talk about, through the hardships and challenges, finding joy.
I was so happy when Carolyn Pearson agreed to do the foreword too, because I might have known zero lesbians that were Mormon my entire life, but the one Mormon that I did know who had said something positive about queer people was Carolyn Pearson. And like, I had known about her since I was a child because my mom loved her poetry. And
we sang her primary songs, right?
Sang her primary songs, read her poems, and she was the only one I knew that had anything to say about being a queer Mormon and that it wasn't necessarily bad. And I also even remembered the story of her and her husband when me and my husband were deciding whether to leave the church, whether to split up. My husband is also gay, we're both gay, and we were trying to figure out, like, how do we navigate this next step, because we love each other, we're best friends, and it's wonderful, and he's my family. And the idea of like a traditional sort of divorce just was very hard to process. It was very hard to think like, what does that even look like? Like, it doesn't make sense. And I remembered Carolyn Pearson, who had lived with her gay ex-husband. And I was like, I could do that. And so we it helped inspire the arrangement we have where we all live together. My ex-husband has an apartment in the basement and my wife and I are upstairs. The kids are everywhere and it's wonderful.
And I'm you're very raising grateful. Your family, raising your children together joyfully. Yeah. It's such a great story. It's such a great example. And I love that you have an essay in this book yourself talking about your experience. Who is this book for? Like, who will benefit? Who will learn from, feel joyful because of reading? Who are the people that you hope read this book? And what kind of an impact do you hope that this book makes?
I think the book is for everybody. Like, the book is, queer Mormons are fascinating. Queer Mormons are living in a double bind that's constant in your entire life. You live in a system that has no place for you, and you carve a place where there is no place. That's defines your entire life. And there's something very, very hopeful about that. And I think that the book is good for Mormons. It's good for queer people. It's good for queer Mormons. I think that it's good for everybody, anybody, even non-Mormons too, like, because there's something about finding a way to make a place of joy, even in a world that will never recognize it, in a world that will never accept you for who you are, and to be able to live and to find that beauty anyway is really wonderful. And so I think everybody should read the book. I think it's a good book.
It is. One of your essayists, of course, is Lori Lee Hall, a transgender woman who I have also interviewed for this podcast because she is also publishing her memoir with us this fall. And in our discussion, we talked about how important it is just to learn about people's experiences who are different from ourselves. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating to learn about all kinds of different folks, and we can learn from each other and recognize we all deserve joy, no matter who we are, no matter what our identity is. And let's support each other in finding joy.
It's so true. It's so true because we have these ideas like, what does it mean to be queer? And it might seem like a strange other thing. What does it mean to be trans? What does it mean to be gay? Like, and we might feel anxious about it or might feel hesitant about it if we've been in a world like the Mormon world where it's just not acceptable. But like when you start to hear people's stories, you start to hear what it's like to be a trans woman, to hear what it's like to be a gay Mormon woman. You start to have a different ability to appreciate it. People's stories are really powerful. People's stories give us new ways to look at the world, and new ways to look at faith, and new ways to look at joy. And I think it's really wonderful to have a chance to hear people's stories.
Absolutely. And while we're on that topic about talking about gender diversity, what I love about your book is you have authors of vast racial backgrounds, racial diversity, and even some folks internationally. So can you want to talk a little bit about that?
I mean, we tried to make as broad and as inclusive of a collection of stories as we possibly could. So yeah, we looked for stories from people from different cultures, people from different countries. Like the only sort of two defining characteristics of most of our essayists are that they are somehow connected to the Mormon church. Most of them have left the Mormon church, but they are Mormon adjacent, and that they are queer. And so we try to include as many different perspectives as possible. We have gay men and gay women and bisexuals and asexuals and intersex people and polyamorous people and trans people and non-binary people. And we tried to get everybody we possibly could into the stories, because we want all the stories told. Like, everybody's story is so interesting and so different and worth hearing. And that was important to me.
Yeah. That's so great. And of course, also across this faith spectrum, you talked about some are post-Mormon, some are still Mormon, all across the spectrum of belief too, which I love that as well. So this is such an exciting book, and I cannot wait to make it available for our readers. It's coming out this May in time for Pride in June, and we're planning some exciting events around the book launch in June that we will tell everyone more about as they come closer. But Carrie, thank you so much again for putting this book together. Thank you for sharing your voice as a lesbian woman. Thank you for publishing with Signature.
Thank you so much.
Well, there you have it. I hope this conversation with all these fascinating authors about their works they're soon to share with the world has gotten you as excited as I am to read their books. Look forward to reading them as Signature starts publishing them in the next several weeks and over the coming year. Thank you.